Judges chapter 8, the third chapter and the final chapter of Gideon's story. It has been a refreshing change of pace for us, studying through the book of Judges to see Israel on an upswing like this. We're well familiar with the cycle of sin that the nation gets stuck in the book of Judges. But this is our third chapter now on, man, just a real upswing, a very encouraging period in the history of the nation during the time of the judges. We know the story back in chapter 6. This is where we got introduced to Gideon. After 7 years of Midianite oppression, Israel had finally had enough, and they had finally called out to the Lord. And eventually God had called Gideon to serve as the sixth judge, if you're counting Barak, the fifth judge otherwise. And chapter 7 is then the chapter that Gideon is most famous for. This is where Gideon started with 32,000 troops against 135,000 Midianites. But then the Lord whittled that down to 10,000, and he still wasn't done. You know the story. I think most of you were here last week. The Lord took it all the way down to 300 Israelites against 135,000 Midianites. Just ridiculous odds, but the Lord was behind those 300 Israelites, and so that was an easy victory over the 135,000 Midianites. Sorry about the cliche, but you plus God, that's a majority. That's just true. I have to say those cliches every now and then because they hold true. The interesting thing to me is that God didn't even bother using Israel's swords. He didn't even bother using their shovels. He didn't ask them to throw fists even. He simply used psychological warfare on the enemy. Here's what that looked like. First of all, the Lord was chipping away at the courage of the Midianites before the Israelites even went into this battle against the Midianites. Midian was already fearing Gideon. Gideon was really a nobody, but it's amazing how the Lord can take your nobody and make you somebody in the eyes of the world. That's what he did with Gideon before he really was a mighty man of valor. The Lord already made him appear that way to the enemy. And, of course, rumor about what the God of Israel had done and the victories of the Israelites that preceded Israel into battle. So they were already on edge. And then, you know, the smoke and mirrors thing began, the midnight campaign against the Midianites, where the Lord sprung that attack on them. The 300 had trumpets, clay pots with lamps inside of them, torches inside of them, and then their shouts. That's all they had. But in the middle of the night when you're in a dead sleep and something like that happens, you wake up, you're already on edge. So you're probably having bad dreams about Israelites coming through your camp and killing you. And then something like that happens, a loud trumpet blaring from 300 trumpets, and you seem to be completely surrounded by the enemy, the Israelites. And then the loud smashing of all the pots and the flickering of lights, man, it just looks like a whole army is descending upon you. So they woke up groggy and panicked, and they ended up falling on each other's swords. They ended up in the frenzy, hacking each other to pieces, while the nation of Israel, the 300, just sat back and watched this all. Their part was done. Blow the trumpets, smash the pots, give a shout, the sword of the Lord, and for Gideon, that's it, you're done. Now just watch the Lord go to work. A pretty incredible story. Obviously, that's the more famous aspect of Gideon's life. But chapter 8, I think, doesn't get nearly enough credit for being as incredible of a chapter it is. There's so much in this chapter. It really is an incredible part. We're seeing an incredible side of Gideon that we just probably wouldn't have expected from chapter 6. That's why I titled this, I think, by the way, it's our longest sermon title ever, The Gideon You Never Heard About in Sunday School. You're going to see a side of Gideon in chapter 8 that's going to just blow your mind if you've never read this chapter before. Now, back to the story of this a little bit, the flow of this. After that initial midnight victory, you had 135,000 Midianites. We don't know how many of them killed each other, but we do know that of those 135,000 Midianites, they either were killed by their own soldiers or they fled. They ran for their life. So that was the victory that night. And now Israel, they're in the process of pursuing the Midianites to wipe them out completely. And that extended toward the end of chapter 7. We saw that Gideon calling for four different tribes to come on out and help them with the cleanup. You know, cut off the Midianites, pursue them, cut them off, and wipe them out. So that's where we're picking up. And as we pick up in chapter 8, we do have statistics at this point. We have numbers of death. We have a casualty count here. It's given to us here in the 8th chapter in verse 10. We're told that of those original 135,000 Midianites at this point, 120,000 of them are dead. And there are only 15,000 Midianites left. That's where we pick up with the chapter. And we're going to see Gideon in his final pursuit to chase after those remaining 15,000 and permanently wipe them out, completely extinguish them so that there's no possibility of them regrouping, repopulizing. Is that the right word? Something like that. Repopulating, there you go. That's the word. Repopulating, forming an army in the future and being a problem in the future. Israel had been bitten by that multiple times in the past, so they don't want something like that again. Now, again, this story is not as well known as the story of Gideon in chapter 7, but it really is a good one, packed with lots that we can learn from. And what I really like about this chapter is that this is where Gideon really comes into his own. This is where we get to meet a different side of Gideon than the one we met. When the angel of the Lord called Gideon, he called him a mighty man of valor, and we don't really get to see that side of Gideon until this chapter. So, interesting chapter for sure. Let's begin. I do apologize, the worship team went late. It bothers me when they do that because then that gives me less time to teach, but I'll just have to do the best that I can until I get a better worship leader in here. Verse 1, Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely. They are mad at Gideon because they feel like they have been excluded from the big showdown. 135,000 Midianites were either killed or put to flight by a measly 300 Israelites. Let's face it, that's going to be a story that sticks. It's going to be a story that's told as a part of the history of the nation for many, many, many years to come. And of course, since it's in the Bible, it's going to be told until the Lord comes back. And now Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, they are upset because their name is not going to be in those discussions once this story gets out. They've missed out on the glory of being in the big fight, in that big moment where Israel was delivered from the hand of the Midianites. So this is exactly, if you'll remember, what the Lord was trying to prevent in the first place in chapter 7. This is the whole reason why the Lord whittled it down from 32,000. Then he sent 22,000 home, whittled it down to 10,000, eventually whittling it down to the 300 lappers. This is why the Lord did this. He did this so that no one would step in and try to rob God of the glory. We talked about that. The glory was important in this situation because the people had recently returned to him, and this was the Lord's way of trying to reestablishing trust with the nation of Israel. He wanted a glorious display. Remember one of Gideon's complaints, "Lord, we just really haven't seen you do anything. We've heard the stories that our ancestors have passed down, but we really personally haven't seen you do anything." So the Lord wants to do something big to rebuild the trust of the nation with him. Now, Ephraim, they were involved. Gideon actually did include them. They've done their part already. You can read about that in chapter 7. We covered this last week, verses 24 and 25. Gideon called on Ephraim to cut off the Midianites at, was it Bethabara? Bethabara, I can just flip back and look. Well, at any rate, He called them to cut off the Midianites, and they did their part. They did just that. And so Gideon is now going to try to calm them down. He's going to try to talk some sense into them. Verse 2, and he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer?" Verse 3, "God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. Now, the comparison of grape gleanings between Ephraim and Abiezer, this is a metaphor. Grape gleanings here would mean the accomplishments of war. And don't forget, Gideon is an Abiezrite. So he's talking about his own tribe here. He's essentially saying, you Ephraimites accomplished more than we Abiezrites did. You got actually like the really good part of this. You got to capture and kill people. You got to kill princes of Midian. We didn't get to do any of that. All we got to do was blow some trumpets, smash some pots, and holler a little bit. That's all we did. No, you had a really good part in this, Ephraim. So he's trying to make them feel better about their part in all of this. He's coddling them, really. He's coddling them. You know, man, you guys were amazing out there. Good job. You did way more than we did. Just absolutely astounding work. Good work, guys. You should be proud of yourselves. Now, this is a bit of a characteristic of the tribe of Ephraim. They do tend to like to show up after the work has already been accomplished and then complain that they weren't involved. This is a tribal characteristic of this group. And we all know there are Christians like that. I'm not talking about an Anchored Fellowship. There's none of them here. But there are Christians like that too, that they don't want to do the work, but if you don't call them to do the work, they want to complain that they weren't involved. You know, you call them three times, they turn you down. You don't call them the fourth time, and then you get scolded for not calling them the fourth time. Why? Because they don't want to really do the work. They don't want to labor for the Lord. They don't want to fight for the Lord in His kingdom, but they do want their name in lights. They do want their name on the contributors list on the overhead. They do want their names on the plaques, on the pews. So if you're finding yourself to have that kind of tendency, you really do need to learn from this tribe, because Ephraim would actually pull this kind of stunt again in chapter 12 when Jephthah was the judge, and Jephthah did not coddle the tribe of Ephraim as Gideon did. What Jephthah did was he declared war on the tribe of Ephraim, and he ended up killing 42,000 of them. So that's a good lesson to learn there. Let's not be like that. Let's not be in it for the recognition. Let's not be in it for the reward. Let's not be in it for the glory. If we don't want to work, then don't complain about not being involved. Ephraim is actually pretty fortunate here that Gideon chooses to coddle them instead of cudgel them, because this here, what you just read, that's the last little bit of grace that you're going to see coming from this judge, this deliverer named Gideon. Here's where Gideon just becomes a completely different person, so it would seem. Verse 4, "And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted, yet pursuing." Sounds like a good summary for ministry workers to me. That's kind of the state you're always in. Exhausted, yet pursuing. You're burnt out in the work, but not burnt out from the work. They are exhausted, yet pursuing. Verse 5, "So he said to the men of Succoth." Now, keep in mind, this is an Israelite city. These are Israelite people, Jewish brothers and sisters that Gideon goes to here. And he says to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, the 300, for they are exhausted." Gideon says, I'm not exhausted. I'm fine. I'm a machine. But my guys, they're exhausted. They need nourishment for the final push of the battle. Can you give us some bread? He says, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian, verse 6, and the officials, the leaders of that community there in Sukkoth, said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army? So Gideon, you just admitted it. You're only in pursuit. You don't have this battle in hand yet. You haven't conquered Zeba and Zalmunna. And you know what? Frankly, we don't believe you can. We don't believe in the cause. We don't believe it's going to be a success. And if you're not successful against these two kings, there's going to be reprisal. There's going to be kickback. And we don't want any kickback from these two nasty kings in Sukkoth. So no bread for you. No bread for you. Typical human response. People don't support what they don't believe has an actual chance of succeeding. That's why I had to give up on my music career. That was supposed to be a joke, but I guess you guys are like, yeah, that's true. Yeah, and it makes sense. I meant it as a joke. Anyway. This does remind us that this battle is far from settled. This is 120,000 Midianite soldiers dead, yes, but there's still 15,000. And at this point, it's only the 300. The 300 from the midnight attack there on Midian. So it's 300 against 15,000 Midianites. And you're just kind of wondering, like, at what point do these 15,000, like someone from these 115,000 Midianites, you would think one of them's got to turn around and say, guys, that's like what, a couple hundred, maybe 300 max? Remind me again why we're running from 300 people and they don't even have weapons. Like they don't even have real weapons. Remind me why we're running from these guys. And, you know, then there's like this reversal and then the chasers become the chasees. That can happen. Don't tell me it can't. I've seen this in Stooges episodes many times. Trust me, it can happen. The chasers can become the chasees. So they need God as much with the 15,000 as they did with the 135,000. This still requires faith. That's the point of all of this. And the people of Sukkoth just don't have it. They don't have faith that Gideon and the 300 are going to be able to wipe out the remaining 15,000. Honestly, I don't know why you doubt it at this point when you've seen what the Lord has done, but people are people, I guess. Verse 7, so Gideon said, well then, and that's the right emphasis. It's written right into the original Hebrew. There was disdain here in the voice of Gideon. Well then, Gideon says, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, not if, but when, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Or if you're from Pennsylvania, jaggers. I'm going to get the jagger branches and I'm going to flog you with them. So again, this is the Gideon you never read about or learned about in Sunday school. This guy went from being afraid of his shadow to suddenly feeling 10 feet thick. And now we know what the Lord saw in this guy. And it's amazing how the Lord knows what's in us before it ever comes out of us. And he just has a perfect way of bringing it out of us. And when he does, it's like we're completely different people. I've seen that so many times in people's lives as they have submitted to the Lord. Kind of a funny story from the past. A couple decades ago, right here in this church, we had a gal that was just such an introvert. She was so quiet, never made a peep. And then we loaded the church up and we went to an event, a church event down in Tennessee. And 22 hours in the vehicle, you know, 11 down and 11 back. I guess that was enough time for the extrovert to come out of her. Somewhere along that trip, she began talking and she has not stopped talking ever since. I haven't seen her for a couple decades. But I can almost guarantee you, wherever she is right now, she's talking someone's ear off like a completely different person. And the Lord can do that for us in a good way. Take what we are, know the depth and the quality that he can get out of us, and then he's able to do that. And when he's done, you're like, whoa, Lord, I was never like this before. I couldn't do this before. How did you do this? It's amazing to see the Lord do that, and he did it with Gideon. Gideon now is that mighty man of valor. Sukkoth refuses support, and Gideon says, all right, once we win, and we will, once we kill all these Midianites, and we will, once we do, I'm going to get a bunch of jagger branches, and I am going to flog the skin right off your back. And maybe you're wondering, is it okay that he does this? And I would just say, listen, he's the judge of Israel at this point, and that's his judgment. Good or bad, God has given him this authority. And now you see why I love the Old Testament so much, because you can't get away with stuff like this in the New Testament. I don't know, something about loving your enemies and doing good to those that hate you, something like that. So, yeah, I love the Old Testament. Verse 8, and from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. In other words, he asked them for bread to nourish the 130 for the remaining battle. And the men of Penuel answered him, as the men of Sukkoth had answered. So they said, again, no way, no bread for you. Verse 9, and he, Gideon, said to the men of Penuel, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. That's Gideon coming in peace. You don't want to see him coming in battle. That's Gideon in peace. I'm coming back here, and I am tearing down your tower. I'm toppling your tower. So Gideon is really filling out his ministry calendar here. Once the battle is done, he's got a whole town to flog and a tower to destroy. Why is he destroying the tower of Penuel? What is a tower? Well, a tower's kind of important to a town, especially at this point in history. A tower is your early warning lookout system for enemies. It's where you spot the enemies before they get to you. And then it's your refuge. It's your place of safety. Everyone runs into the tower and they're safe. So Gideon is promising to come back and destroy their sense of security. And what he's wanting to do, I think, is teach them a lesson in where their trust really belongs. That as the Bible teaches us, the Lord is our refuge, and the Lord is our strong tower. That's what we should be trusting in. We should have faith and confidence in him. It's a lesson that Gideon is going to teach. Well, he's going to try to teach this to the people of Penuel. Verse 10, now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. So again, there's where we get that number. There's 15,000 soldiers left. And just another reminder of how miraculous this battle has been. 135,000 Midianites and their allies drew their swords against the people of Israel. 120,000 of those who drew their swords are currently dead. And most of that was accomplished without Israeli swords, but with psychological warfare through the whole trumpet sounding and pot breaking and shouting during that midnight raid. Verse 11, and Gideon went up by the way to the tent dwellers east of Nobah and Jogbeha and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. I guess they thought that Israel was no longer pursuing them at that point. Maybe that was because Gideon got a little delayed stopping and asking for bread. But they catch back up. Verse 12, and Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the armies into a panic. Remember, this is 300 people doing this, 300 people throwing an army of 15,000 into panic. The Lord clearly still at work in miraculous ways. I wish we had like a full account. Lord, what were you doing here? How did this happen? But just incredible stuff we can be sure of. Verse 13, then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. And Heres means the sun And I think that's why the King James Version translators got confused here and translated this to say that they pursued them, or pardon me, they returned from the battle from the rising of the sun. But it's actually a hill or a mountain, a well-known hill or mountain, referred to as the Ascent of Heres or the Mountain of Heres. So the New King James Version and the ESV, the English Standard Version, they both get this right. It's the Ascent of Heres, verse 14. And he captured a young man of Succoth. All right, what's Succoth again? That's the first town that refused to give Gideon bread for his soldiers. So he's coming back now to Succoth. And he captured this young man and questioned him. He interrogated him. And he, the young man, wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. Now, you know why Gideon wants this list, don't you? It was the leaders of Succoth that refused the bread. We don't know where the common folk stood on this. I don't know if you're aware of this, but governments don't always speak for the common folk. Governments sometimes do what they want and definitely not what the people want. And Gideon does not punish the commoners here. He punishes the leaders. At least that's his aim here. You've heard of kicking butt and taking names. Well, Gideon is taking names so that he can flog some backs. That's what's happening here. He wants the list. I don't know how he got it out of this guy. Maybe they had to waterboard the guy. Or maybe they had to make a deal with the guy, a plea deal, a promise of leniency in exchange. But whatever they did, they got this guy to spill the beans. They got this guy to spill his guts. He gives them the entire hierarchy of the city of Succoth. 77 leaders, 77 names. This guy snitched. And now Gideon knows who to go after by name. Verse 15. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?'" Gideon remembers this word for word. He did not forget this. Verse 16. And he took the elders of the city, and he took the jaggers of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. Boy, did he ever. Much different than the Sunday school lesson. He taught them a pretty serious lesson. Gideon was good for his word here. He made a promise, "I'm coming back with jagger branches. I'm filleting your backs." And he delivered on that promise. Succoth taunted Gideon with these two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. So Gideon planned for this teaching moment by saying to the guys, "Hey, do not kill those two kings. We are capturing those two kings. We are taking them back to Succoth. I have a special lesson for the people of Succoth there." So that way he can show up with these two guys captured, these two powerful kings captured by the 300, and say, "Are these your boys? These are the guys you were worried about? These are the guys you taunted me with? Are these the guys that you said I could not conquer? These guys right here in chains, bound up, captured, prisoners of war? Yeah, time for you to learn a lesson." And then Gideon has those 77 men flogged with briars. Much worse than switches, you know, for the older folks who their parents dealt with them through switches. Branches from the trees, big deal, just a wooden stick. Man, these are assault switches, you know? All of these thorns on them. This would do some serious damage. This would teach a pretty serious lesson. Again, you ask, is this something that is okay for Gideon to do? Yep. The Lord called him to be judge. And this is his judge in this situation for the people of Succoth. Verse 17, and he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Whoa, okay, hold on. Be careful with this one now. He killed the men of Peniel. He didn't threaten to kill them. He only threatened to tear down their tower. Why did he end up killing them? We have to be careful with this one. I don't think this was at all the intention of Gideon. I think this ended up happening as a result of the response of the men of Peniel. And the ancient rabbis confirmed this. They taught this, that this has been handed down. It has been long held that when the 300 showed up to tear down this tower, that the people of Peniel, in order to defend their tower, they fought against the 300, and the 300 killed them all. And it would be the same kind of situation. All of the men of Peniel, that is way more than 300. But God is fighting for these 300, so they would badly miscalculate. These men would badly miscalculate to say there's only 300 of them. There's no way they're toppling my tower. We're going to fight. We're going to defend that tower. We're going to whoop these 300, but God is in the 300. And so the whole town of men end up destroyed in this very poor judgment on behalf of the leaders of Peniel. It's just a terrible scene all the way around. You know, your team won, and you resisted aid in the battle, and all that the commander is requiring of you is that you be taught a lesson. And instead of allowing yourself to be taught that lesson, to admit that you're wrong, instead you choose this hill to die on. You end up dying on the hill of your own mistake. They never did get the opportunity to learn from that mistake. At least the people of Succoth, they had sore backs for a while, but they got to learn the lesson. The people of Peniel did not get to learn that lesson because they chose to die on that hill of mistake. We got to be careful with that as well. It's just good to be people that are willing to admit when we're wrong and then let the Lord, if he's going to scold us, because sometimes he does do that, and if he's going to scold us, let the Lord scold us. Take it like a man, take it like a woman. Let the Lord teach us the lesson. Sometimes he may even use his leaders to do that. And that's a very humbling thing for a person, to have a leader scold them and to be able to take that scolding, receive it as correction from the Lord, and learn from the lesson. Verse 18, then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? Interesting. This is new info here. We don't know anything about men dying at Tabor yet. We're just now getting this story for the first time. And in the context of these verses, it's going to tell us everything we need to know about what happened in Tabor. Gideon says, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? And they answered, as you are, so were they. Huh. You know, now that you ask, Gideon, those guys we killed at Tabor, they looked an awful lot like you. Isn't that weird? Every one of them resembled the son of a king. Yeah, they had that same noble look that you do, Gideon. Uh-oh. They look like you. Oh, boy. Verse 19. And he, Gideon, said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. So in other words, hello, my name is Gideon. You killed my brothers. Prepare to die. The Princess Bride, 1987. Let's ask another question to keep Gideon accountable. Is Gideon justified in killing these two men? Interesting question. Is he justified? Yep, he sure is. He's justified for killing these two men because there is a section in the law of Moses that most of you Wednesday nighters should know very well, because we covered this in Numbers chapter 35. You can also find it in Deuteronomy chapter 19. It's called the law of the avenger of blood. You remember what that is? If someone in your family is murdered, your family then appoints an avenger of blood, and it's that family member's responsibility to avenge that murder. It's their responsibility to track down the murderer and kill them. Now, if this was an accidental death, if it was involuntary manslaughter, then the Lord provided cities of refuge for those innocent killers to escape to. They killed your family member by accident, but you don't want to accept that. You're just mad. So the person that killed innocently, he can flee to a city of refuge. But either way, it is the avenger of blood's responsibility to track down the killer, get to the bottom of the situation, and level the judgment that is necessary in the given situation. So yes, Gideon is justified in doing this. This is according to the law of Moses. Verse 20, I guess I should point out that law is no longer active and applicable. Just to cover my base, I don't want any lawsuits. I don't think our insurance is that good. Verse 20, so he said to Jether, his firstborn, Gideon's firstborn son, rise and kill them. But the young man did not draw his sword. And yes, notice the people of Israel have swords now. How do they have swords? Well, they just killed 120,000 people with swords. So these are spoils of war. They have swords now, but the young man was too afraid to draw his sword. He was afraid because he was still a young man. Now, what Gideon was actually trying to do here was give his son like a really high honor. This was thought to be a really high honor to kill these two enemy kings. First of all, his son would be able to fulfill the law of Moses as the avenger of blood for his family. That was an honor. And then secondly, he would have the honor of being spoken about as the young man that killed these two kings. So Zeba and Zalmunna, these are trophies on this kid's wall, but his son was not quite ready for that. He was young and inexperienced, and I think he made a really good decision, because at that age, I would have to think something like that would just wreck your mind for good. There are plenty of adults who can't even handle doing something like this, let alone a child. So good decision. Maybe Gideon's heart was in the right place. I don't know. Good decision by the kid to say, no thanks, Dad. You take care of it. Verse 21, then Zeba and Zalmunna said to Gideon, rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength. That is translated very literally, so it's clunky, but it's a way of saying it takes a real man to do a real man's job. That's pretty much what's being said here. Or you can measure the strength of a man by the action that he takes. It's a saying very similar to like that. Gideon, no, you just be a man and you do this. And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. Now, just a thought here, they could have tried pleading for mercy. They could have tried promising lifetime loyalty in exchange for leniency, in exchange for their lives. And who knows, that might have worked. Gideon is a man of God, and God loves mercy. Worth a shot. And they didn't try that. They didn't plead for their lives. They surrendered to execution. And if you know you're going to be executed, how do you want that done? Maybe you don't sit and think about these kind of things, but I have to. I'm a Bible teacher. If you know you're being executed, how do you want that done? You want that done by a pro. Quick. That's the word I was looking for right there. You want a pro handling this. If someone's going to kill you, you want a man. And I mean, you want a strong man, because you want to know he can take you out with one blow. You don't want this to take like 4 or 5 hacks. And you definitely don't want a youth to be your executioner. He's much weaker. He's inexperienced. You might end up with 20 to 30 hacks before you die. You don't want that. You want put out of your misery quick. You don't want to suffer. It's pretty smart. They say, no, please, Gideon, mighty man of valor, put us out of our misery. If we got to die, put us out of our misery. There's also the possibility that this involves the honor of battle. It was thought to be an honor to be killed by the guy that defeated you in battle, as opposed to some uninvolved third party. That would be shameful. That would be a dishonor. And perhaps that is actually what Gideon had in mind here. That one final shaming of these two men, his enemies, Ziba and Zalmunna. One last note about verse 21 before we move on. I want you to notice here the symbol of the crescent moons that were hanging around the necks of the Midianite camels. That crescent moon is actually one of, if not the most ancient, the oldest religious symbol in the history of the world. Christians didn't start using symbols until, you know, well after Jesus with the fish and eventually the cross. But the crescent moon, that goes back to 2100 BC when the Babylons were in Mesopotamia. And you can track the use of that that crescent moon religious symbol. It was a symbol of moon worship, obviously. And that has a history from the Babylonians all the way through the Midianites here that we're reading about in Judges chapter 8. And here's something maybe you didn't know. The Midianites and the Ishmaelites, they come from two different lines from Abraham, but they ended up blending. You can read about that in Genesis chapter 37. Those two tribes blended, and they are oftentimes Midianite and Ishmaelite. Those two words are used interchangeably. That's going to happen in this chapter here. So when you're looking at the history of the Midianites, you're actually looking at the history of the Ishmaelites. The reason I'm bringing this up is because what common and huge world religion today comes from the tribe of Ishmael? That's Islam and the Muslims. So I don't know if you realize it or not, but the crescent moon is still the religious symbol to this day of the Muslims. Now, I know it like had its creation in 610, I believe it was, under Muhammad. That's when the religion was invented. But I'm telling you, its roots come all the way back to Midian. They go all the way back to Babylon. And there's this consistent use of this symbol, this religious symbol of the crescent moon. Verse 22. You can research that more on your own if you'd like. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also." They want a three-generation dynasty here. "Gideon, you be king now. Your son can be king in your place when you croak, and then your grandson when he croaks." They want a three-generation dynasty. "For you have saved us from the hand of Midian." Verse 23. Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Now, Gideon is saying all of the right things here. This is definitely what this group needs to hear right now. They need to hear, hey, we're back with the Lord. We don't need an earthly king. We have a heavenly one. The Lord's leading us. You don't need me to lead us. Hey, we're just following the Lord, and this is the way that it needs to be. So he's saying all of the right things here. Ooh, but I don't know, folks. Things end up becoming very questionable from this point forward. Verse 24. And Gideon said to them, "Let me make a request of you. Every one of you, give me the earrings from his spoil." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So again, who's he talking about here when he says Ishmaelites? Same group he's been talking about the whole time, the Midianites, right? Just to clarify, because this verse is confusing, the Ishmaelites had golden earrings. The Israelites conquered the Ishmaelites here, a.k.a. the Midianites. And as a result, those earrings are now theirs, spoils of war. Verse 25, and they answered, "We will willingly give them." Have at them. You can have our earrings. And they spread a cloak, and every man threw in it the earrings of the spoil, and the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pennants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. Now, I just want to say real quick, you know your nation is rich when their camels wear bling. I mean, if your camels are blinged out, then you have way too much money on your hands. They probably even had heated leather seats and powered windows on those camels, but blinged out camels. Now, 1,700 shekels, that would be around 50 to 75, 60 pounds, somewhere in there, of gold. It's a lot of gold. But then once you add up the rest of this, you're probably somewhere near 100 pounds of gold. So we'll just take that number and we'll multiply that by the current price of gold. I think I know what it is. It changes quick, but currently that would put this at approximately $2.5 million in modern-day U.S. terms. This is a lot of gold, a lot of money here, a lot of value. Verse 27, and Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah. And all Israel whored after it there. So God considered idolatry to be spiritual adultery. That's the comparison he always makes. So when he's talking about whoredom, he's actually talking about spiritual idolatry in this case. All Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. Now, a few weeks ago in our Exodus studies, I'm just kidding, that was like 4 years ago. But when we were studying through Exodus, and we were studying Exodus chapter 28, we saw there that the high priest was supposed to wear a robe, an ephod, and a breastplate. The robe was blue, and then on top of that was the ephod, and it was like a vest, and it was gold and red and blue, but it was threaded. It was a cloth garment. And then on top of that, of course, sat the breastplate with the Urim and the Thummim. But we're looking at the ephod here, the sort of the second layer, the vest of the high priest. That is what Gideon chooses to make into a golden memorial or golden monument to the Lord here, a golden ephod. Now, I am fairly certain that Gideon had good intentions in doing this. I would have to think he only had good things in mind, like a monument. That wasn't something new to the nation. They were used to the Lord saying, hey, build a monument. But you have to be careful with that. The Lord had to always keep it simple. Pile up a bunch of rocks. That'll be your monument. Well, Gideon's monument is a gold ephod, probably 100 pound golden ephod. And as good as his intentions were, what he does here is he creates a monster. I'm sure his intentions were something like this. Lord, the priest is responsible for interceding for the people. Lord, you are our high priest in this. We're doing this to honor you. But this ends up being just one great, big, gigantic temptation for idolatry to people who just left idolatry and always seem to have this perpetual struggle with idolatry. So, of course, the people turn to idolatry. They start to worship the golden ephod that Gideon made. And oftentimes that's just how it goes. You know, you start by having a crucifix hanging up on the wall and you're praying and you're praying. One day you're praying and you look up at the crucifix and you have a moment. And then that prayer is miraculously answered. And you go, huh. And the next day when you pray, you got the crucifix in your hand. And then a couple days later, you're rubbing it and you're praying to it and you're worshiping it. It becomes an idol. And I know that's really an embellishment of how this works. It can happen a lot more subtly, a lot more in an undetectable way until it's on you and you realize, oh my goodness, I have an idol in my life. We have to be so careful with that. The best thing that we can do is just not create anything that could give us the temptation or the potential to begin to worship it. We know that the nation of Israel did this with the bronze serpent that the Lord had Moses make. And if Moses was wise, when they were done with that thing, he would have ground it down to powder and cast it into the sea. He didn't do that. And the Bible teaches us that the nation of Israel started to worship the bronze serpent. They turned that into an idol. I've shared this with you fairly recently. And it was in the days of King Hezekiah that he was just like fed up with the idolatry. And he said, enough is enough. and he took the bronze serpent of Moses, along with the other things, the Asherah, the idols, the other idols that they were worshiping. But he took that bronze serpent and he broke it into pieces. And if you remember, I told you this story that tradition has it that the nation of Israel didn't let that stop them. They actually continued on worshiping the pieces of the broken bronze serpent. You know, what do you do when you have an artifact like that that people start to worship? You break it down, they worship the pieces. If you grind it down to powder, guess what? They're going to worship the powder. The only thing you can do is grind it down to powder, take it out into the middle of the ocean, and just dump it out of sight, out of mind, so that the people have no potential to worship it. The absolute best thing to do is just not make something that could turn into an idol in the first place. But if you are going to make it, you've got to deal with it very severely, or else the people are still going to find a way of worshiping it. So, incredible here. I would summarize it like this. The gold of the enemy was more of a threat to the nation of Israel than were the swords of the enemy. Swords couldn't take Israel down here, but gold did. And I think that's a pretty apt description of America. Man, we've had such a great military for a long time. People can't take us down. Oh, they want to. They can't take us down. But guess what? We don't need a military to take us down. All it takes are a handful of people with a whole lot of money that can buy up the news media outlets and the politicians that are running for office and throw money at the issue. And, well, I guess I better move on. I digress before I get myself into trouble. Verse 28. Let's finish this up. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they, the Midianites, raised their heads no more. This was a total defeat that the Midianites could not recover from. And the land had rest for 40 years in the days of Gideon, which tells us that Gideon lived another 40 years after that victory over the Midianites here in chapters 7 and 8. Verse 9, Jerubbaal, Gideon, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. We call that retirement. When you're not retired, you live in the office. Once you retire, you finally get to live in your house. You get to actually enjoy your life. Gideon is retired from public service here. Verse 30, now Gideon had 70 sons. Wow. Yeah, wow is right. Hard to tell how many daughters. We're not even talking daughters here. He could have had 120 kids, 200 kids. 70 sons. His own offspring. And I mean, unless you marry an Amish woman, one wife cannot give birth to that many children. So, you know what's coming here, don't you? 70 sons. How do you think he got those 70 sons? It wasn't from one poor old woman. He got those 70 sons for he had many wives. Polygamy. And that is a sin. There's no doubt about that. Why do we see men in the Old Testament living in polygamy? Well, it's because they are being disobedient to the Lord in that area of their lives. They did know better back then. They just did not obey. So just because a man, a hero like Gideon, does something like this, it does not condone the practice. One thing I do like about the Bible is that it records history, good or bad. That actually lends to the authenticity and the credibility of the book. The Bible is the only religious book, quote unquote, religious book like this, that tells on its heroes of the faith, that tells the truth about them, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that leaves the work of figuring out right and wrong to us and in the way that we properly balance the Word of God. Just because a man of God does it in the Scriptures, that doesn't mean it's good to do. Balance all of the Scriptures to make sure you know what you're doing. Verse 31, and his concubine. What in the world does this guy need concubines for? Concubines were exclusively for sexual pleasure. He has dozens of wives, 30, 40 wives. Who knows? He has a lot of wives. And with all that kid making, when in the world does he have time for concubines? But he has concubines. And his concubine who was in Shechem. So maybe, I don't know, maybe he had one like in every city just in case he was traveling. But he had one in Shechem, and she also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. And here's where things get extremely, extremely weird, if you can imagine it getting any worse. Abimelech means my father is king. Abba, father, Melech, king. Abba Melech, that means my father is king, or dad is king. So you catch this, right? The guy that said, I will not be your king. We don't need a king. The Lord is our king. The guy that said that, what does he name his kid? My dad is king. I mean, is that sending a mixed message or what? Maybe he was talking about Abba Father. The Lord is my king. I want to give Gideon all of the benefit of the doubt here, but if you really just add all of this up, it doesn't look good for Gideon. Gideon and his family were ensnared by idol worshiping the golden ephod that he had created. Gideon became a polygamist, like a professional, like big time polygamist. And Gideon did, it seems, end up thinking himself to be a king over Israel, the very thing that he said that he wouldn't do. Now, I would not accuse Gideon of not making heaven. That is above my pay grade. That's the Lord's call. He's the judge. All I know is that Gideon does make it into the Hebrews chapter 11 Hall of Faith chapter. And as far as I'm concerned, the Hall of Faith chapter is not for apostates. It's not for people that went apostate at the end of their lives. So I give Gideon the benefit of the doubt. I'm expecting to see him in heaven, even though he didn't finish well. But regardless, we'll leave the judgment to the Lord. Regardless of all that, there's enough here in Gideon's story to remind us the importance of needing to finish well. The Bible is replete with heroes of the faith who didn't finish well. And we can learn from their errors at the ends of their lives. But thank the Lord, the Bible is filled with heroes of the faith that did finish well. Just since we're out of time, I'll give you the one that comes to mind most readily, the Apostle Paul. Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. So Gideon was a little bit of a flash in the pan, and we don't want that. We don't want flash in the pan Christianity, where we do well for a while, but then we fizzle out and cool off at the end of our lives. I think we want to burn bright for the Lord all the way to the end and go out in a blaze of glory for the Lord. All right, now one last thing here. If this son of Gideon to the concubine is mentioned in verse 31, don't you think there's probably a reason for that? There is. That means, hey, get to know this guy, and you're going to see him in the next chapter. All right, so we're going to see Gideon's son in the next chapter. Good or bad guy, you can read ahead, up to you. Verse 32, let's finish this out. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash with his father, at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Verse 33, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Baal-berith means Baal of the covenant. I think this is twisted. I think it's like taking Yahweh, the Lord of the covenant, and Baal and making a combination. It's like taking the best things that you like about Yahweh and combining them with the things you like about Baal, and you have yourself a new deity here, Baal-berith, Baal of the covenant. Verse 34, and the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. So sad. Verse 35, and they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. So indeed, a sad ending to a great story, a disappointing conclusion to a wonderful man of God, Gideon.